Thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and we love to hear from you. We're so happy with our archives because many of you who don't listen live Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on Progressive Radio Network. You also, by the way, can visit us now because the station actually has an app. And you can actually get the app by going to your app store. All you have to do is go to the app store on your cell phone and search Progressive Radio Network. And on this app, you can download and listen live to PRN shows. And by the way, you can also listen to our past archive shows. So there's so many ways for you to listen to Progressive Radio Network and all the wonderful programming we have on there. For Dr. Zamperon and myself, we welcome your questions. You can find us at naturalnurse.com. And you can join us in person as well. For instance, we have classes almost every day at the Hippocrates Health Institute. I am teaching a workshop called Ancient Wisdom of Healing Plants. And we're going to go outside, gather wild, edible, and medicinal plants, make them into medicine, and you get to take them home. And we'll be making a spiritual amulet bag. We'll be making an herbal tincture. And we'll be making a skin salve that you get to take home on your own, as well as herbal teas. What will we be making them out of? Well, we don't know yet. We will have to see what wild plants are growing in Hippocrates, both in the garden, but more importantly, the wild plants. You really want to learn the wild plants in your area, because I can't tell you how many people, probably hundreds, have called me to thank us for teaching herbal medicine, outside plant identification, and wildcrafting, which we have been doing now literally 50 years. I can't believe that many years have gone by. But when we're having these events, such as storms and hurricanes, and when people lose their electrics for various reasons, if you know what plants you can use that grow outside for food and medicine, then it becomes not only a fun hobby, but a very important, true survival skill that I think should just be everyone's basic knowledge, not something that is, you know, really unknown. So with that, we have a wonderful guest today who has been really focusing on herbals as well, and her name is Brittany Wood Nickerson, and I said her middle name is Wood. And Brittany is a practicing herbalist, author, health educator, and cook. And she combines knowledge of nutrition and a passion for food as medicine in her training. And she has studied Western, Ayurvedic, and Chinese herbal medicine. Her support and coaching approach emphasizes personal empowerment, preventive health care, and whole body wellness. Brittany is the founder and primary instructor at Thyme Herbal, and that's Thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, where she teaches a three-year herbal apprenticeship program, as well as courses in herbal cooking and homesteading. She also teaches at the University of Massachusetts and is the organizer of the Northampton Amherst Herbal Meetup Group locally in her area. Brittany is a passionate teacher and an inspirational speaker, and she presents at conferences throughout the country. She's also an author with several wonderful books. One is an Everyday Living series, and we're going to be looking today at her beautiful brand-new book, Full Color. It's just gorgeous, called Recipe from the Herbalist Kitchen, Delicious, Nourishing Food for Lifelong Health and Well-Being. So welcome, Brittany, to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Yes, we're very happy to have you. This is actually a pleasure to have you on because I love to have herbalists share their knowledge. Let's go back in time to see where you first found yourself drawn to either natural medicine or, you know, plants started to talk to you like they do to me? Or where did this all begin in terms of your path?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, like many of us who find ourselves on the natural health plant medicine journey, it started in my childhood when I think many of us have that access to a deeper connection with plants in the natural world. And for me, I think I feel really lucky and fortunate that I grew up in an environment and in a community where there were people around me that knew about plant medicine and herbalism. And so rather than that just being sort of a fleeting part of my childhood, it was able to take hold in a little bit more of a powerful way. I had a mentor who was a family friend in my community, who's a practicing herbalist and a practitioner of plant spirit medicine. And I took my first herbal class with her when I was 12 years old.
At 12, yeah. That's great. So your mother must have supported this, because I don't think you were working at 12 and getting yourself around and paying for your own classes.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I think my mom was on to me. I think she knew. And she saw this this class advertised in the local school, you know, paper, bulletin or whatnot. And she said, hey, you want to take this class? And it was actually geared around herbal gift making. So it was a holiday class. And I was definitely the youngest person there. But I live in the community where I grew up in. And so some of the women who were in that class have actually circled back around and taken classes with me now. So it's pretty beautiful to see that come around full circle.
Yes, it is. So you had this really within your childhood that you found yourself sort of drawn. Now, the class you described, you said, was spirit medicine. So how did that relate to gift making?
Well, so she is the woman who taught it is an herbalist and a practitioner of plant spirit medicine. But this class was mostly focused around making little home remedies. And we made dream pillows and sachets and lip balms and teas and those things in that class. And she was also very into food as medicine. There's a recipe in Recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen that's directly inspired by that woman. Her name is Jean, and the dandelion muffin recipe is not her recipe, but she's the first one that ever made me a dandelion muffin, and I thought that it was the most amazing thing ever.
Well,
and I still do think they're pretty delicious.
Why don't we visit that in your book? Your book is beautiful. I'm wondering, you know, it's not often that you get these great full-color books.
Yeah.
You know, very often publishers don't want to, you know, it's additional money to get it printed that way. But they're beautifully illustrated.
Thank you. I think that it turned out so gorgeous. And I was really lucky to work with the folks at Story Publishing, who are amazing. And I had an amazing book designer who really came to my house and saw my vision and understood my work and really crafted the book to reflect that. So it really does feel like a true expression of my feelings around food as medicine and this home, my herbal school and my home.
Well, one thing that's wonderful, too, is, as you probably know, because I work in many different aspects of herbal medicine, including legal ramifications, and in particular, legal ramifications of people who are sort of starting out and, you know, let's say make some tinctures or soaps or something really wonderful that's healthy and beautiful, and it works for them and their family, so they think, wow, I'd really like to share this. You know, with my community and then the world. And they start to sell it, but unfortunately, meeting the regulatory requirements, which they usually don't even know about when they start, are now really beyond most people's means. I mean, we're talking millions to even come out with one product. But your way of sharing gets around all of that, because you're focusing on food, which it's not regulated to use herbs as food. And even if you teach people to do their own home crafts with tinctures and soaps, that is still legal. It's only when you start to sell it commercially that all those, I think, draconian rules, you know, go into effect.
Yeah, and I think that that's an important thing for us all to remember, and I'm so glad you brought it up, because it really is a good reminder of how we want to continue to progress with this movement of the sort of revival of home health care and herbal medicine is that we want it, I would like to see it remain something that is in the hands of people, in their homes, in their everyday environments, teaching people to make their own medicine. And as you said just before I came on the air, this idea of teaching people what herbs are growing right around them in their backyards and in their communities, not just because they're valuable medicine and it's part of a survival skill, but also because sometimes those plants that are growing right around us are exactly the plants we need. You know, in spring, the plants that come up first are the plants we need first to invigorate the metabolism and stimulate liver function and whatnot. So I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. And I've always come back to wanting to be and stand in this movement as a teacher, because I don't really want to make things for people. That's not my personality, and it's not my gift, but it's also part of my vision for the world, is that I want people to have this information and to be able to implement it for themselves in their own home. So I think that's, we need that. You know, there's plenty of consumerism already happening in the world. I think we need more of that kind of do-it-yourself spirit.
And that's very good advice. But also for new herbalists coming in, it's such a good path that you have chosen, because you can share this knowledge with people, but you don't have to be ducking your head, you know, that the FDA is coming any minute. So very unfortunate. Yeah. I don't support that's happening, but I do think
people need to know,
because sometimes they really get themselves in hot water and they go, but it really does help. Yes, it really does help, but that's not the point.
Yeah.
You know, so how you're presenting it is just beautiful. So I looked up.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's. I can't wait to try some of these recipes. Now, you're talking about this dandelion flour muffins, and because you talked about herbs of spring, and dandelion is certainly one that's wonderful to use because it does not have poisonous look-alike, and almost anyone can identify it.
Yeah.
So you're making it from the flowers, it looks like, in the recipe.
Yeah, and it's one of the, I don't have a lot of preparations that I use dandelion flowers for, but this is one of them. And the flowers bring a really nice texture and a slightly polleny flavor to whatever you cook them in with. And my favorite application of them is any kind of baked good or something like that. I love them in a muffin. I love them in a pancake. And then also the famous preparation for dandelion flowers is to make like a dandelion wine or a dandelion mead, which I occasionally do. But I love this recipe because it really just embodies that spirit of the season. And in the head note to this recipe, I talk about the iconic spring landscape with here in New England anyways, with that kind of yellow hue across the fields at the beginning of spring when you've been sort of starved for color all winter. And it just elicits this childlike joy in you. And I think that the first time I ate one of these muffins, that's what it felt like for me as well. And I love to be able to incorporate wild foods because I just think that they bring that essence right into the food and you kind of feel that in your spirit. And they're also something to look forward to because I'm not going to be making dandelion flour muffins right now in January, but I can look forward to them in the spring, which I think is part of this whole, you know, lifestyle around herbal medicine, is living close to the earth in that way.
And let me ask you this about dandelion flowers. I've never tried this, but let's say someone loves this recipe. Would it work at all to gather the flowers and freeze them and then be able to use them later, or would they be too mushy? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it would change the texture, and they would probably still be good, but I've never tried that, so I can't speak to how it would change the hydration of the recipe. Usually when things freeze, the water, they kind of release water in a different way because the cell wall breaks down. So I'm not sure how it would change the hydration of the recipe. You might need to, squeeze out a little of the water first. But I would think it would be worth a try. I love freezing things so that I can enjoy them during later seasons.
Well, I do too. And something I do a lot of is cranberries, because they seem to work really well even all year, but they're only fresh, especially because I get organic ones that one time of year. But I use them with steamed vegetables. I actually make steamed vegetables and throw cranberries in with it.
Ooh, that sounds good.
You know,
I've never tried that.
It does give it that little tang, which I like.
Yeah.
And with the dandelion, too, you're not using the flowers, which, you are using the flowers, you're not using the leaves, which tend to be more bitter.
Right. So for this recipe, we're more going for in the sweet direction, and the bitter flavor is actually more introduced by the lavender. These are lavender and dandelion flower muffins. And the lavender is really fun because it's so aromatic that the kind of steam inside the muffin as it bakes releases the aromatics. If you do bite down on a lavender flower, you might taste a little bitterness, but not much. And that recipe is in the spring chapter. That's part of the chapter is actually called Adapt, and it goes through each of the four seasons. There's another chapter called Challenge, and the Challenge chapter is really about of challenging the metabolic system and stimulating metabolism as a way to support the digestion of food. I talk a lot about in this book about how it's not just what foods we eat and the quality of those foods, but also the quality of the digestion, because if we don't digest them well, we won't get the nutrients from them. So I talk a lot about digestion and the importance of that. And the challenge chapter really focuses on the importance of having challenging flavors in the diet, because things that taste strong, like the cranberries in your steamed vegetables, those are sour, or, you know, the taste of a dandelion green in a salad or something bitter, really stimulates the metabolism and stimulates the digestion. And that helps you to absorb nutrients in all the food that you eat during that meal. So the challenge chapter really focuses on these challenging flavors, of which dandelion greens, which are quite bitter, are one of them. So I just flipped through to another recipe, which is dandelion greens with garlic mustard vinaigrette. And that's sort of the, you know, using the other part of the plant. You use the flowers and the muffins, which are more sort of sweet and decadent. And then you're harvesting those greens from the same plant, and the tender greens in the spring lend themselves really well to salads or even cooking with them. And you can eat them as part of a meal to stimulate the metabolism and support digestion of nutrients in all the foods you're eating.
Let's delve more deeply into that concept of challenge. I think that is really very interesting in terms of the fact that the American diet is really very deficient in flavors. The only flavors we seem to have in what we'll call the SAD, SAD, standard American diet, really is sweet and salt. It's very deficient in things like bitters or pungent. Why don't you explain a little bit about some of those other flavors and why they actually are important for human health, and they are in all kinds of ethnic cooking.
Yeah, exactly. So there's five flavors, as I outline in the book, and most health systems around the world recognize those five flavors as the primary flavors. There's sweet, salty, bitter, sometimes astringent, but I'll talk about that in a minute, sour, and pungent. And the order is actually important. They go in order of the heaviest to the lightest. So we start with sweet and salty, then we go to sour, sometimes astringent, bitter, and then pungent. That's the order. And so most systems, healing systems, recognize those five flavors. Ayurveda, which I work with very closely, actually recognizes six, and they talk about astringent as being its own flavor. In Chinese medicine, astringent is linked in with the sour category, and in the book, I outline and give profiles on the five flavors, and astringent I include in the sour category with a little bit of its own information as well. So we'll think about and focus on those five flavors. And as you said, sweet and salty are the most common in the average American diet. And it's for good reason. The sweet flavor is by far the most nourishing of all the flavors. And just to be clear, when we talk about sweet, we're not talking about cookies and sugar and cake and that kind of stuff. We're talking about sweet almost as in bland. Things like the staple foods around the world, brown rice, white rice, quinoa, millet, potatoes, oats, and then moving into high fat and protein foods that are very nourishing, meats, fats, etc. Things like milk and cream, chicken and chicken fat, all those kinds of things. So those foods are, you know, they taste good to us for a reason, because they're very nourishing. They're very supportive. They build the substance of their body. They build tissue. They build bone. They build fluids. So we need them, and they are staple foods for a reason. They should actually comprise the bulk of the diet. Salty, there's two different kinds of salty flavor. One is the mineral salt flavor, and the other is the true salt flavor. True salt comes from like the table salt that you might sprinkle or season your food with. And the mineral salt flavor is the natural taste of salt as exists in high mineral, usually vegetables. So great examples are parsley, celery, cilantro, Swiss chard, spinach. These are a spectrum of high mineral vegetables that actually taste salty. Now, many people wouldn't tell you that they taste salty because they're used to table salt on potato chips and whatnot, and that's a very different spectrum of salt. But they really do. If you just like don't have any salt in your mouth or anything and you taste a piece of Swiss chard or celery, you can taste that natural salt. And that is indicative of minerals. So that's another category that we know is so important to our health, is that this how these high mineral vegetables. Many are leafy greens, but there's a whole spectrum of them, right? And so those food groups are very important. And salt, actually, even sodium chloride is important to health for our water balance and whatnot. But the tricky part, as I'm sure many people know, is that we eat so much sodium in processed foods that we actually are consuming more than is healthy for our body. And one of the things I talk about in the book is getting back to good salt in our diet and eating unrefined salts, which have sodium chloride in them, but they also have the whole spectrum of minerals that are naturally occurring either in the ocean.
So, you know, we have to take a little break right here. And I want to remind you that you are listening to wonderful author Brittany Wood Nickerson. She's talking about her book, The Herbalist Kitchen. She also offers all kinds of classes and workshops. You can find out more at www.timeherbal, that's T-H-Y-M-E-H-E-R-B-A-L.com. Take a little break right here, and when we come back, we will be continuing our discussion with Brittany Wood Nickerson. We'll be right back with more here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll take a look at the soybean, its phytochemistry, and its role as a food and medicine.
It is exciting to see a resurgence in research by universities and food scientists on the role that foods play in disease prevention. Many of these institutions, such as the United Soybean Board, the American Soybean Farmers Association, and the National Cancer Institute, are busy developing designer foods, or superfoods, concentrating the essential nutrients and phytochemicals in soybeans and other foods that have potent medicinal effects. Commonly known foods which have soy in them include soy milk, a cheese-like substance called tofu, tempeh, a fermented soy protein, and tamari, a fermented soy sauce. The soybean is a rich source of many nutrients, including selenium, zinc, beta-carotene, vitamins A, C, and E, and 20 of the 22 amino acids. Soy also contains essential fatty acids.
Research on soy foods is vast and well known to health enthusiasts, although the general public and physicians in the United States may not be aware of this plethora of research. In Japan and China, however, this is not the case, as a voluminous number of scientific studies have been carried out in animals and humans. Chinese studies reveal that soy products can increase the ability, rate of activity, and number of white blood cells. Patients receiving chemotherapy and radiation can benefit from drinking soy milk, which in several studies demonstrated a protective effect on the liver and gastrointestinal system.
It is interesting to note that the British journal Lancet revealed that vegetarians and Asians who ingest high amounts of soy have the lowest rates of cancer. This is due to one of soy's constituents called genistein. This chemical is a phytoestrogen or plant estrogen, which can decrease and block the uptake of human estrogen and testosterone, as well as enhance its excretion. Like the drug tamoxifen, it competes with estrogen for uptake in the reproductive tissues. By doing so, hormone-dependent cancers like ovarian, breast, and prostate cancers may be prevented.
In conditions where there is a deficiency of hormones, such as osteoporosis and menopause, soy isoflavones, such as genistein, can weakly mimic estrogen and reduce the severity of these problems.
So, listeners, don't count out the versatile soybean. Make it a delicious and nutritious part of your natural medicine chest.
Nurse and Dr. C right here on our station, Progressive Radio Network, and you can listen anytime. You can also go to your app store and get Progressive Radio Network as an app, which is really exciting. We often play those natural medicine chats, and it's interesting because at one point, one of our listeners, and listeners are always writing to us, and I love your comments. So basically, they heard that one before, which is about soy, and we did get quite a bit of pushback. So I just want to modify that a little bit. What we talked about is true. There is excellent research on soy because it is a phytochemical that has some hormonal activity, but a phytoestrogen, which can be very protective if it fits into estrogen receptor sites. But there are some very big issues with soy. One is that it must be organic. If it is not organic, I would suggest you don't use it. And even some commercial things, like I live in Florida, so there's a town called Boca Raton, Florida, so there's something that's a burger that has that name too. That is not organic, and if it's not organic, then it is highly sprayed with chemicals and also is genetically modified. So that you definitely want to stay away from. The other thing is that people do react differently to soy. And also, many times when people adopt a vegan or vegetarian diet, they way overdo the soy, and it becomes a problem and interferes with thyroid function. And it also depends on who you are. For instance, an older woman like myself, soy can be very, very useful. It can be helpful through hot flashes and other kinds of hormonal irregularities. But it's not good when you give it to young children, let's say babies, especially baby boys, in high amounts such as in formula, which is genetically modified soy. So I just wanted to say, although we talked about some of the research benefits of soy, which there are also a lot of downsides. So like anything else, you need to study it deeply. And that's one of the wonderful things about our guest today, Brittany Wood Nickerson, and her book, Recipe from the Herbalist Kitchen, and her website, Thyme Herbal, that's T-H-Y-M-E Herbal, because she really goes into great depths of study about the things she's talking about. This is not just a sort of pass-over little thing. It's really well-researched. So welcome back to the show, Brittany.
Thank you.
Tell me about your name, Wood. Where did that come from? That's ironic.
That's
right?
A given middle name from my parents, who thought it was really beautiful. And my dad's a woodworker, and the house I was born in, I was born at home, and the house I was born in has beautiful wood paneling all over the whole house. And so I think it was just this sort of combination of them feeling a connection with wood and also loving the name. And I really think it's a beautiful name. So I've always just used my middle name. And like people get confused. They wonder if it's hyphenated or whatnot. It's not. It's just my middle name. But I love the whole thing, so I use it.
And it certainly, you know, vibrates with what you've chosen to have both as your interest and your life's work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a good synchronicity. Or maybe you can just say I was born with parents that were a good fit for me.
Right, and that you've pursued this, not in a light way. I mean, I find your work very, very in-depth in terms of
thank you.
Investigating. Like we were talking about the flavors, which I think is still worth going a little bit more deeply into, because
yeah.
people eschew bitter in terms of
yeah.
the standard American diet, but it's
yeah.
so important. And even if we use a medicinal herb that you may not use as a culinary, let's say golden seal, which is high in berberine, we actually mm-hmm. know the mechanism of action of how that stimulates the nerves on the tongue when you taste it so that they yeah. release digestive enzymes.
Yes. And it's not just, you know, golden seal, berberine-containing plants are a very strong example of a bitter, but anytime you taste the taste of bitter on the tongue, even if you just taste it, like one swish of coffee and spit it out, you know, just that flavor of bitter, or a bite of a bitter green like a dandelion green or a bitter lettuce, will stimulate these receptors on the taste on the tongue. And those receptor taste buds are linked in with the enteric nervous system. And the enteric nervous system is a branch of the autonomic nervous system. It has almost as many neurons as the brain and the spinal cord, and it runs the length of the GI tract from the mouth to the anus. And it stimulates the entire process of digestion, the opening and closing of sphincters, the movement of peristalsis, which is the muscular action that moves food through the GI tract, and then, of course, the release of these acids and enzymes. So it starts in the stomach, helps with the release of hydrochloric acid and pepsin, stimulates the secretion of enzymes from the pancreas, and then the release of bile from the liver and the gallbladder. So every single one of those enzymatic releases helps with the digestion of some different kind of food. And that helps break the food, the nutrients down into digestible and absorbable pieces. So going back to what we were talking about before, it's this idea we talk so much in our culture about what we're eating and whether or not it's good for us, but we're not talking about whether or not we're digesting it. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing such a big rise in food allergies and digestive issues is because we have compromised digestive health. So even if we're eating really healthy foods, if we're not digesting them, we can still not feel good, and we can also still not be digesting good nutrients. So the bitter flavor is actually really important to reintegrate into the diet, because it helps with digestion because of that chemical and physiological cascade that we just talked about. And then sour, another flavor that we don't have as much of, we have a little more but not as much of, is also really important because the sour flavor also stimulates liver function, stimulates the secretion of stomach acids, and helps to bolster the digestive system and support absorption of nutrients. And then lastly, pungent, which people might relate to more as the spicy flavor, is also really important for the same thing. What that does is it actually warms the digestive tract, and by encouraging blood flow, it helps to encourage secretion of enzymes and also, importantly, absorption of nutrients from the GI tract, mostly the small intestine. So just by cooking and making your food taste delicious and more flavorful, you're actually cooking medicinally. And I love that because I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and there was this idea that health food was kind of bland and boring. And I've really graduated into this place of feeling like the better your food tastes, the better it is. And this is not like packaged processed food, but when you're cooking for yourself and you season lightly with salt and you add delicious herbs and lemon and other, you know, diverse flavor profiles that make food taste really exciting, you're actually making it healthier by making it more absorbable because you're introducing those diverse flavor profiles. So that's sort of the recipe of cooking. If you look back at thousands of years of human culinary experience, the simple sort of formula is you take a sweet, bland staple food and you jazz it up with these more diverse, interesting tasting flavors, the sour, bitter, salty, and pungent. And that kind of that is your recipe in a way. You know, there can be variation within that. But that's your recipe. And sure, we do it because it tastes good. And sure, we do it because there's thousands of years of culinary evolution behind it. But we also do it because it's medicinal. And that's one of the things I really want people to like feel in their bones, is that our cultural heritage, our culinary heritage, is so closely tied to food as medicine, but we just don't know it. And we don't think about it that way. We think about it more from the flavor perspective. But it's very empowering, I think, to kind of turn that around and see it from that lens.
It is. And interesting as well, because, now let me ask you this, in terms of kale, because most people have heard of kale. I don't experience kale as a bitter, but as a professional herbalist chef, would you consider kale as a bitter?
I think it's a mild bitter. I don't think that it's a strong bitter. And I also think that it really depends a lot on the time of year that it gets harvested. For example, if you're harvesting kale in the warmer months and during the height of the growing season, it has a tendency to be a little more bitter. But as it gets colder and the weather gets colder and starts to frost, the kale actually gets really sweet. So I think that it can kind of depend, but in general, it has a tendency to be more mild, and it can be very sweet. And the other thing about kale is that there's this movement, especially with local agriculture in my area. People are eating a lot of baby salad greens, like baby kales and things like this, and eating them raw. Those have a tendency to be only mildly bitter and actually a little bit more pungent. And so it's important for people to understand the difference between pungent and bitter. Something like arugula, for example, that's not bitter. It's much more pungent. So to think of pungent, you think of spicy, almost like the flavor of black pepper. And you know, just kind of remembering that, yeah, pungent's good, but we also want to get bitter into our diet. And kale also might have a very mild salty taste to some people, depending. And again, that would be indicative of the quality and content of minerals. So, you know, eating kale,
because it's become kind of, you know, that's something that people like yourself and myself, who've been involved in natural healing really my whole life, my own children, who are probably older than you, they were never vaccinated. They grew up on a farm where I raised all my own food. They never had an antibiotic or a drug of any kind. And, you know, that's a very different perspective than what most people have. But when I ask people, do you like kale, they used to, like, make a face and go, oh, no, it's so bitter. And I said, have you ever tasted it? And the answer was no. So your explanation was beautiful in terms of the multifaceted way. But kale is one thing that actually is making its way into mainstream.
It is. It's because greens in general, but especially kale, have become kind of trendy, and they've kind of become synonymous with healthy eating. Like, people are putting kale in their smoothies and everything. It's like, if they're eating kale, they feel good about their diet.
You're right. So it's come a long way. And it's wonderful, your representation of the complexity of the flavor. When we're talking about a plant, we're not talking about a manufactured thing that is always the same.
Isn't that great? And that's it, just stripping it down and going back to the simplicity. There's so much wisdom there.
Well, on your website, Thyme Herbal, which I definitely will recommend, by the way, our show will be archived, as are all the shows, and now people can go to their app store and they can download the app for the station, which is Progressive Radio Network, and once they have the app, they can listen live or any time. And your show will be archived, as well as we have hundreds of shows archived on here. And also at our website at naturalnurse.com, we have a link to all of our archives. So we will have, for those people who might be listening today and they're driving and they're finding your information so interesting, they can get a copy of your book. And also go to your website, which is Thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, Herbal. And you have a lot of interesting information there. Like, you do a lot of classes as well. And then you have online classes.
Yes. So earlier in the show, you brought up my sort of tilt in my work, which is as an educator. I really love teaching, and I love teaching because it empowers people to be able to do things themselves. So rather than, you know, learning that elderberry is good for you and going out and buying an elderberry syrup or an elderberry tincture, I teach them what the plant looks like, how and when to harvest it, and how to make medicine. And I think that that's empowering because people then have the power to, you know, kind of do that themselves. But also because when you walk around the world and you're living out in the world and you're surrounded by plants and you know their use and you know their name, you all of a sudden just kind of feel like the natural world is your friend and they're your allies and they're there for you. And my students just reflect time and time again that this is a life-changing experience for them. So I am really passionate about my teaching and I love it. And my most popular class, my sort of cornerstone class for my business is the Art of Home Herbalism. And it's about using herbs for home use and personal development. And if folks are interested, they can continue on to study for 2 more years and really like go into depth in more deeper applications of herbal medicine. But the idea is let's start with home use. All of us need to start with home use and integrating herbs into our everyday life. And after 5 or more years of teaching that class, I wanted to make it accessible to people who didn't just live in my area. And so I put the program online. It has videos for all the hands-on medicine making and outside harvesting have videos. And then there's audio recordings for a lot of lectures. There's reading assignments and at-home activities. And I have people all over the country now taking this class. And it just makes me really happy because not everybody has access within driving distance to study herbal medicine. So making it accessible online, especially with this video and auditory component of the learning, is really exciting to me and feels very inspiring. So that's the Art of Home Herbalism
online. That makes it so much more widespread in terms of, you know, who can get it. Of course, the plants you're going to be talking about might not be available, let's say, in the Southwest, you know, Bisbee, Arizona,
right,
where I have a place, or here deep in South Florida, we have a different compendium of plants. But the ones you're talking about are quite widespread throughout the Northeast and even the middle of the country.
Yes, and I recommend usually that folks can try to find something in their area. Like one of the required readings is a field guide to their area. So wherever they live, they pick a field guide. And then there's a botany book that's really great called Botany in a Day that kind of teaches principles of plant ID. So the course doesn't really focus on regional plants just because people are taking it from all over the country, but it focuses more on plants that are either pretty commonly naturalized or plants that can be grown, and then teaches the basic skills for people learning the biodiversity of their area. And I always encourage folks to try to find like maybe wildflower groups or local plant ID classes so they can continue to learn their bioregion, because I do think that's really important.
Well, we're going to take another little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and you get to hear about some other shows right here on Progressive Radio Network. And remember, you can now download the app. That's new, by the way. And we'll be back very soon. You can always contact me at naturalnurse.com, and you can look at this beautiful book, Recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen, written by our knowledgeable guest today. Her name is Brittany Wood Nickerson, and we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is John Lobel. You can hear my show Visionaries at 10 a.m. on Mondays on PRN. And guess what? PRN now has its own app. So you've always been able to listen to our shows by going to your web browser and putting in PRN.fm. And then you can listen to the current show that's on air. But you can now download onto your smartphone, Android and iPhone, our PRN browser. Search for it in your app store, and you can listen live to whatever's on at the moment. So download now our PRN.fm app.
Mm-hmm. Are you interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
Progressive Radio Network, the number one network for those who care about the truth.
Okay, and we're back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you for listening. We're going to continue our discussion with author Brittany Wood Nickerson from The Herbalist Kitchen. That's her book, Recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen. And you can find her and her work and her online as well as on-ground classes at timeherbal.com. Welcome back, Brittany.
Thank you so much.
Now, you have some very interesting information in your book that actually is new to me, and that's why I've been doing this radio show. I guess we started it around 1979. It's been a little while, and I'm always learning new things. And I love your idea of herb food combinations that actually changed health benefits. Like one I saw is dill helps the body digest cheddar crackers. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. The culinary herbs that I outline in the book are probably familiar to many people, dill, rosemary, thyme, sage, garlic, etc. And most of them fall into a category of herbal action that you're probably familiar with called carminative. And carminatives are herbs that help to bring blood to the digestive tract, which helps to break food down into more digestible nutrient components and then absorb them. And it also helps to relax the GI tract, which eases tension, helps to support peristalsis, and relaxes sphincters, which if anybody has gas or bloating or other kinds of digestive upsets, they just kind of release that. So there's carminatives are sort of a catch-all digestive remedy. And it's not surprising to me anyways that they're included in a lot of food because they help us to digest our food. So dill is a really great carminative, and it has a very wonderful effect on the GI tract of relaxing the muscles and helping to, again, support that blood flow, which helps with the breakdown and absorption. And it also will help to release bile from the liver and gallbladder, which will help with the digestion of fat. So we think of a cheddar cracker. This is kind of a takeoff on like the Cheez-It or the organic Annie's Bunny or whatnot. And it's like a popular American snack. And that really just tastes salty and maybe a little tiny bit sour if you're lucky, but there's probably even sugar in there, right? So there's not any diverse flavors going on at all. So the addition of the dill tastes delicious, I think, with the cheddar. And helps to not only have those physiological effects that I described before, but it brings up that interesting flavor profile, which I think tastes yummy and sort of gourmet, but then also stimulates that taste bud receptor on the tongue that we spoke about earlier when we were talking about bitter. Even though dill is only very mild bitter, just even that little bit will help and make those crackers more digestible. So those crackers are actually in the comfort food chapter. And there's a whole chapter in this book on comfort foods and how we don't have to demonize comfort foods if we understand why the body wants them, why it might need them, and then how we can transform them with either our cooking or how we use them in our diet to make them, you know, healthy for us rather than something that's going to hold us back or cause bad cycles or patterns.
Well, you have a lot of very interesting and wonderful recipes in this book. I'm just going through it, and it's so attractive. Here's one that sounds delicious, cilantro lemonade. Never thought of that kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you brought up the kind of food herb combination and what that does. cilantro is an amazingly powerful medicinal herb. It's very cooling, so it helps to relieve heat in the body. It's excellent for the liver. It helps to balance blood sugar levels. I use it a lot for people who have insulin receptor issues, which would be in the beginning stages of type 2 diabetes or metabolic syndrome. And it also is a chelator. It helps to remove heavy metals and other toxins from the system. So I love trying to make recipes that get medicinal doses of an herb like cilantro that has so many deep benefits into the diet. So cilantro pesto is one of the recipes in the book. That's an example. And then the cilantro lemonade. With each serving of the cilantro lemonade, you're getting a medicinal sized portion of that cilantro. And it's a particularly good remedy for people who feel that they have excess heat in their system. Maybe they sweat or blush easily. Or maybe they have hot emotions like anger or frustration or rage that are close to the surface. And it's really great for the winter months. For the summer months, the opposite of the winter months, when it's hot out, to have cilantro lemonade to help cool you off and help deal with hot temperatures. So I use it in a lot of different ways, sometimes just seasonally, and then other times I actually will recommend it to clients as a medicine for themselves. And it's delicious, too. It's sweetened with just a little bit of raw honey, and it actually has a little salt in it to help make it more hydrating. And then it has the cilantro and lemon, which is sort of the key of that lemonade piece. And it looks, I mean, you see the picture in the book. It looks almost like a green drink.
It does, but it probably tastes more lemony than green. And, you know, it's interesting, too, with cilantro. There's a folk belief, but also this is backed by scientific evidence, that cilantro can act as a chelating agent and actually grab heavy metals and take them out of the body. So it
exactly
really has so many wonderful effects.
And they have done studies on that, especially they did it specifically with lead, but I suspect that it chelates other heavy metals as well.
And so I noticed, too, that your book is very herby, obviously, but it is not vegan, which I actually think is more balanced view, because you do have some, you know, you have ghee in here, which is an animal-based product, and you have chicken soup. So what is your feeling about that?
I missed what you said. Did you say it's not vegan?
Right. It's not a vegan.
Yeah.
There's plenty of vegan recipes, but it looks like your philosophy is not strictly vegan.
Yes, that's exactly right. So I have done a lot of research on food, of course, and one of the researchers that I really resonate with is the work of Dr. Weston A. Price. And Weston Price was a dentist practicing in the United States in the 1930s, and he traveled around the world studying traditional diets and found that there was a great nutritional difference between the traditional diets that people were eating and the diets they were eating under the influence of the Western culture. And so his research is really interesting because it doesn't say that there's any one correct or most healthful traditional diet. He instead pulls out themes of traditional diets. And what he finds is that all diets around the world, all traditional diets, include some kind of animal product or animal byproduct. He didn't find a vegetarian or vegan diet anywhere in the world, and he studied 15 traditional cultures living in remote areas all over the world.
Well, the only one I have ever discovered would be the Jains. Some of the Buddhist, the Hindu Jain sects are, but very, very rare. And they don't live that long either.
Right. Oh, interesting. Yeah, interesting. And so one of the things he found is that these traditional diets were much higher in fat-soluble vitamins as well as minerals. And it was cool. He found great variation. Some of the diets ate almost all animal product. Some of the diets had very little animal product, maybe only 10%. But all of them that he studied anyways had at least a little bit. And so for me, I have really – so take that. That's a big influence. And then I also have my influence of Ayurveda. And Ayurveda actually works with diet on a constitutional level, helping to pick a dietary path that is unique for the individual person and what their needs are. And what I find is that in our culture, most people, like all of us, need at least some fat. And I find that fat sources from animal and animal byproducts are the most absorbable and the easiest to use in the system. And that all of us need at least some of those fats. And that depending on our constitution, some of us will need more and others may need less.
We have come to the end of our time. So I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Excellent, excellent information, super well researched and very, very balanced. And I love your website. To remind our audience, that is Thyme Herbal, T-H-Y-M-E. I love your description, Brittany, of how you chose that name and how you chose your logo. Everything is done so consciously. And the food looks absolutely delicious. The recipes are easy to follow. I highly recommend Recipes from the Herbalist Kitchen by Brittany Wood Nickerson, delicious, nourishing food for lifelong health and well-being. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, and we're hoping that you stay healthy.